Welcome back to the program. Today we are all part of networks. Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram all bring people together to share news, opinions, and their lives. But in all this excitement about social networks, are we missing something? Why aren't we using them to better decipher our collective national temperature and to better understand and appreciate how to help each other? Rather than the long tail of technology pulling us apart, as some claim, perhaps it really is the key to bringing us together. And then perhaps by using these networks and crowdsourcing to bring us closer together, then and only then might we understand the real gulfs between us. These are just some of the ideas put forth by my guest Stephen Johnson in his new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Stephen Johnson is the author of the previous bestsellers, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Everything Bad is Good for You. It is my pleasure to welcome Stephen Johnson back to this program to talk about Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Stephen Johnson, thanks so much for being back on the program.
It's great to be back.
In many ways, much of what you're talking about in Future Perfect is community organizing, but using technology and networks in order to do that.
Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it. I mean, I think what has changed, and actually as I've been starting to talk about the book, one of the things that I've said is that the values and the kinds of networks that I'm talking about, where people are kind of collaborating, building projects together without necessarily having traditional private property ownership claims over those things, and sharing their ideas freely without patents and licensing agreements and so on. That one of the things I said is when we talk about that kind of collaboration, you know, a lot of people kind of nod their heads and they're like, yeah, you must be from Northern California. That sounds like something that would happen, you know, with basket weavers on a commune somewhere in Mendocino or something like that. But the truth is, it's that kind of organization, it's that kind of what I call in the book peer network, that actually built the internet and built the web and built all the open source software that's in almost every computer that we use today and built Wikipedia. So the idea that that kind of cooperative network solving problems, you know, the difference between now and, say, 35 years ago is that we can point to things like the internet and say, this is a kind of approach that actually solves big, you know, problems on the scale of the planet, and it's not just some kind of utopian fantasy. And I think that's, as an inspiration, that is really, that's very powerful.
We tend to think of everything today in very binary terms. It's either government that has to be involved or the market forces that have to be involved or some combination of the two, although we become more and more polarized of late. What you're talking about essentially is a third way.
That's right. That it's, and by the way, it's not about replacing governments and states or corporations and markets. It's just saying that there's an additional tool in our kind of toolbox here that we can use in many situations. And if you, you know, the way that we kind of organize ourselves politically, where the left is, you know, it really champions the power of government to kind of provide safety nets, and the right believes just in the unfettered power of the marketplace, the people that I'm chronicling in the book, which I'm calling the peer progressives, they believe that there's this additional force, which is these peer networks of folks organizing in a kind of decentralized and much more diverse way, many more people involved in the decision-making process with these kind of open networks of collaboration. And you know, that's why it's important to point to the internet and say, listen, when it came time to organize, you know, all the information in the world and connect all these computers all around the world, the organization that came up with the best solution was not the government, although the government funded some of it, and it was not the private sector. It was, in fact, the peer network, computer scientists all around the world collaborating in this open architecture.
When we look at it, though, in terms of trying to solve bigger problems, do we run into the problem that it becomes a self-selecting population, that it becomes a creative class operation with everybody else left out?
I think that's a risk, but, you know, one of the core peer progressive values is diversity, not the diversity of the kind of old left, the multicultural diversity, not the diversity for the sake of social tolerance, which is a fine, admirable value, but not what I'm kind of emphasizing here. It's diversity in for the sake of making better decisions. There's a whole long history of scholarship that looks into this from a lot of different angles. It shows that groups that are more diverse in their backgrounds and their professions, when they come together to solve a problem, will outperform a more talented group of like-minded people. So the slogan for this is diversity trumps ability, right? And so the argument here is that when you create more people, you bring more people into the process, you'll have actually better solutions to the problems you're facing in a society, and that includes, you know, economic diversity. That includes, you know, ethnic diversity, right? So we can't have a situation where it's just, you know, a small elite. That would be a betrayal of kind of the values that I'm talking about. I think that it's important to stress that this is not necessarily, though, about technology. So one of the key things that I look at in the book is a really remarkable history of something called participatory budgeting, which started in Brazil, in Porto Alegre, in 1989. And it's a system where these neighborhoods gather together every year and they hold these kind of referenda where they talk about what the priorities are in their neighborhood. You know, they need to extend the sewer line to here, or they want to add another room to the school, or they want to build a community garden or playground here. And they're given a slice of the city budget, of taxpayer dollars, that they can allocate directly to the projects that they kind of decide on. They create a ranked list of priorities for their neighborhood. And it's had a tremendous impact. It's now spreading around the world. Over 10% of European cities use some version of this. But it had an amazing effect, one, in that it reduced kind of waste and corruption because, you know, people could see the projects that they'd asked for, and if they didn't show up on time, they were, you know, they were angry. They were, you know, we asked for this, you know, new room in the school. Where is it? And also it created this feedback loop where people got more involved in the process and they saw results and they felt like, wow, if I do show up for these things, my world gets better. And so talk about, I mean, this is a very poor city. In 1989, there's no internet, there's no web down there, there's no smartphones. There's just people getting together face-to-face and having these conversations. But the kind of architecture of their social relationships and the decision-making process, that was a peer network, too. So it can work on all those different levels.
What about the idea, and Steve Jobs talks about this in Walter Isaacson's biography, that people don't know what they want, they need to be told?
Well, you know, that's kind of the innovation question. Actually, I wrote about this a lot in my last book, Where Good Ideas Come From, that we tend to have this idea that great innovation, you know, new products, new services, comes from, you know, the Steve Jobs figures, the Edisons, the Henry Fords, who have, you know, some visionary idea that's so far ahead of everybody else, and they introduce this thing through the sheer force of their kind of creative energy. And it's true that there are people like Steve Jobs, but they are by far away the exception, not the rule. And in fact, one of the things we've learned from the internet is the power of, in network theory we call this the edges of the network, the power of kind of ordinary users when they're given a platform to come up with interesting new uses for the technology that that the creators never dreamed of. I mean, Twitter is used in all these amazing ways now that the Twitter guys never thought about when they were originally designing the service. There are all these kind of conventions and usage patterns and using it for political protests and all this stuff that have come from people who weren't actually working for Twitter. But because it was an open platform that was much more diverse and decentralized, people could steer it in new directions. So, yes, the average person, you know, next to a Steve Jobs is never going to, you know, be as innovative or as creative. But if you've got 10,000 people, all of whom are experimenting in their own ways and coming up with new ideas, and there's some mechanism for a good idea from that crowd to spread, that crowd will ultimately outperform the Steve Jobs. Maybe not the Steve Jobs. He may be the one person that you couldn't outperform, but you're slightly more human Steve Jobs, I suppose.
This is the energy that we get from urban environments. This is why cities are inherently so successful.
That's right. I mean, I'm sitting here in my hotel room looking out over West Village and Chelsea of Manhattan, and, you know, there's a long history of, you know, of innovation that has been tied to dense urban settlements. There's a study, I didn't talk about it in this book, but I talked about it in the last one, about where they looked at the relationship between population size in cities and creativity, basically, you know, kind of new patents created, creative arts, you know, a whole set of data points for innovation and creativity. And what they found was it's not that cities get, you know, more creative as they get bigger. They get disproportionately more creative as they get bigger. So a city that is 10 times larger than another city is on average 30 times more innovative in what it does. And it's because when you crowd people together, you get this amazing, what economists call information spillover, where ideas are just kind of free to flow from mind to mind, and people are able to kind of build on other ideas, and different professions come together, and different walks of life come together, and they inspire each other. And it's that, it's the collision between all these things, not necessarily the competition between all these things. That's the problem, is we just default assume in this society that what drives innovation is competitive pressure with other kind of rivals. But cities show us that actually it's as much about kind of borrowing ideas and building on them or taking them in new directions as it is about trying to out-compete your neighbors.
And that's really what's changed about management today, that there is more focus on collaboration and people and ideas bumping into each other as opposed to just being competitive.
Well, look, having celebrated New York, let me do the shout-out to Northern California. You know, the one thing we agree on in this society, in the U.S. right now, in terms of the economy, is that despite all our problems, Silicon Valley and the tech sector is the most innovative economic force on the planet, basically, and, you know, has been an unbelievable success story, and we continue to, you know, be the envy of the world in terms of companies like Apple and Google and, you know, Amazon and so on. So the question is, why is that? And you know, there are a bunch of different explanations, but one of the ones I don't think we hear enough about is if you go back and look at the first early tech companies like Fairchild and then Intel in the 60s and early 70s, one of the key things that they did that was very striking is that they created much less hierarchical kind of org charts inside of their organizations. So they're, you know, they allowed a lot more kind of participation. It was much more like a peer network because they were really founded by a bunch of engineers. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't really want to have a big, heavy, you know, nobody had a special parking place and there wasn't this big corporate hierarchy. And crucially, they introduced stock option plans where everybody participated in the success of the company. Stock options were a very unusual thing. They were not something that was usually done at, you know, East Coast companies, for instance. And so from the beginning, these tech sector companies out here had a much more of a kind of like, you know, bottom-up structure to them, despite the fact that they were private companies. And it's clear that that was part of their success and is part of the tradition of the tech sector that has been kind of defining and important in its, you know, kind of track record that it's had over the last 30 or 40 years. So I think corporations, you know, even inside the private sector, corporations have a lot to learn from this kind of peer network approach.
Is there something, though, that we're battling against in our collective consciousness and our collective DNA that looks for a certain kind of leadership, that looks for hierarchical organizations?
Yes, I think that's true. You know, it's interesting. There's a wonderful new book by E.O. Wilson called The Social Conquest of Earth, which came out about 6 months ago. And one of the things that Wilson talks about is actually that, you know, if you look at it on the kind of long evolutionary time scale of the last, you know, 100,000 years, 200,000 years, for the vast majority of that period, human beings lived, you know, in much less hierarchical societies, in kind of small bands, you know, 100 to 200 humans. There were leaders, but there wasn't anything resembling, you know, the huge organizational structure of a government or of a modern corporation, and there people looked up to people, and you know there were definitely like chiefs and kind of leaders, but there wasn't that kind of extraordinary vast hierarchy that we've now built in modern society. So, in terms of our human kind of cognitive biases, if you had to figure out what was the most artificial thing, the most artificial thing is definitely, you know, working for an organization of 20,000 people where you're, you know, so far from the CEO you can't even imagine it, and he's on this huge pedestal. That was not the way our brains evolved. So we do want role models. We do like leaders, and it's not like leaders go away in this formula. And as I said, there's not it's not like there isn't a continued role for governments and corporations. It's just that there are parts of life that actually are better organized around peers and better organized around these kinds of networks.
And one of the examples you use is Kickstarter, for example, which has been so successful.
Kickstarter is the peer network approach to how do you fund creative work? How do you fund artists who are not yet supported fully by the marketplace? And the old way of doing that was to build a big government institution like the NEA or build a big philanthropic institution like the Duke Foundation or something like that. But what Kickstarter said is, geez, you know, the world is probably filled with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who might want to give $10 or $50 to support a creative project just for the love of it, not for any economic return on their investment, just for the kind of excitement of contributing to something that should be in the world that they want to see happen. And so they created this platform that basically builds peer networks of funding, crowdfunding as they call it. And it's 3 years old, and it's actually bigger in terms of the dollars flowing through it now than the NEA. It's only 3 years old. So, you know, the question is not, you know, will it ever be as big as something like the NEA? The question is it going to be 10 times bigger than the NEA, which is remarkable.
The other side of it in a more mundane kind of way, with respect to using vast amounts of data and networks, is something like 311 in New York, which you talk about.
Yeah, 311 is a great example of how a city government can use the power of peer networks, to make its ability to function much more, you know, kind of adept and flexible. So 311 allows anybody who can dial three numbers on a phone to call in, ask questions about city services, report problems like a pothole, and the city takes in all this data while they answer the questions. They have live human beings at these call centers to answer questions so you don't just get a recorded message. They take in all this data and they use it to map and kind of categorize all the shifting problems and needs in the city of 8 million people. And it's been a huge success story. I mean, they've fielded over 100 million calls, and they've gotten much better at kind of, you know, noticing where the problems are, where we need more services in this area because we keep getting calls about it, or there's a lot of problems with potholes on 72nd Street. We got to send somebody out there to do it. And what they've done is, again, they've decentralized and diversified the number of voices that are kind of contributing to the city government's sense of what's going on in the city, right? Instead of just hiring a bunch of experts on the payroll of the government, they've deputized, in a sense, anyone who could dial three numbers on a phone to be part of that process. And they did a survey a couple of years ago where they ranked various different kinds of call centers from different industries. And 311, in terms of customer satisfaction, was at the top, tied only with kind of high-end hotel and retail chains. And, you know, in the middle was the IRS, and then at the very bottom were the cable companies.
Perfect.
But you know, there. Look, that's a situation where a big city government is showing up at the very top in terms of customer relations with an innovative new platform. I mean, when's the last time you heard about a local government doing something like that? That is not new. Normally the story is like, I went to the DMV and I wanted to shoot myself because it was so awful and terrible. But cities, because they can now use these kinds of platforms if they apply themselves, they can actually do better than the private sector and give citizens a real service that they find useful.
Coming back around to where we started in terms of this synthesis of government, the private sector, and also these peer networks, it then becomes a situation where nobody can totally take credit for something, and you get into situations like we saw when the president was talking about who built what a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine about this weekend. The president wrote, the president in his "You Didn't Build That" speech went on to say, you know, the government built the internet so that then businesses could build stuff on top of the internet. And then a few weeks later, there was a kind of rebuttal in the Wall Street Journal, which said, oh, the government building the internet, that's a myth. Really, the private sector did it. And, you know, you can understand why those two positions conditions are there, you know, someone on the left wants to show that the government is capable of building these platforms and innovating in and of itself, and someone on the right wants to make the argument that government's role is always overrated and the private sector is really the driver of change and progress and so on. And this is one of these cases where, because there wasn't this third alternative, it was kind of hard to figure out what the right answer was. Certainly the government gets more credit. The government did fund a lot of the kind of early research what became known as the ARPANET, which is the predecessor of the Internet. But almost no one who was building the Internet in the early days was working for a government agency. And they were really kind of a network of kind of academics or folks in think tanks, and some of them were funded by the government and were kind of directed by the government to do certain things. But most of it was this open collaboration. And then everything that came after that, I mean, the web was really not funded by government research at all, and it was very much built by these kind of peer networks. And so what I was trying to say about that kind of debate, you know, yes, the government is important, but there's actually this other kind of institution here that we don't hear nearly enough about. And it's important to remind people that, one, because of what I've said about what peer networks can do in other contexts, but the other thing, the other reason why it's important to tell that story about the Internet is that we don't have enough, you know, kind of myths, master narratives in our society about group collaboration and the power of groups to solve problems or come up with new ideas. And it's so much easier to tell the Steve Jobs story or the Thomas Edison story because there's a single person. We like to hear about the heroes and all that kind of stuff. But so much of progress comes from, you know, thousands of people kind of tinkering with an idea and improving on it and building on other people's ideas. And that doesn't make as tidy a story, but it doesn't mean that it's not true. And so what I've tried to do, in a lot of my books, is figure out ways to tell narratives. And this book is filled with stories. Right? It's not a political theory book. It's a book that's got lots of kind of narratives in it that celebrate that kind of collaboration, in large part to inspire us to do more of it.
And can we look towards the existing kind of social networks that we're dealing with today, things like Twitter and Facebook, et cetera, as the building blocks of this kind of peer progressive action?
They make it easier, just as the Internet made it easier, the web made it easier. You know, it was almost impossible to create a peer network global encyclopedia before the Internet came along. And so having these network structures as part of our lives gives us a great platform for that. But I don't want it to be, I'm trying to make a very clear position here that I'm not a cyber utopian in the sense that I don't think that all the world's problems can be solved just by getting people on Facebook. In fact, a lot of what people do on Facebook is a tremendous waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a fun waste of time, a lovely waste of time, but not really making the world better, just kind of looking at pictures of your friends from the party last night. So we have to, you know, it's like democracy. It's like the institution of democracy. It's an incredible tool. It's the best tool in general for that kind of the question of how do we create our leaders. But you can abuse it. You can vote for the wrong person. You can opt out. And so we have these tools. We have these platforms, but they aren't an answer in and of themselves. We have to kind of steer them towards the kind of society that we want to have.
But can they begin to be the building blocks? Are they the things that make us understand better the value of these kind of networks?
Yes, although, you know, it's interesting. There's a difference, actually, between Facebook and Twitter in that Facebook wants you to have kind of friend relationships where it's a two-way relationship, and that tends to create kind of smaller groups because everybody has to kind of know each other because it's two-way. You have to approve of the friend relationship. Whereas Twitter is this one-way relationship where you can follow someone who doesn't even know who you are. And so Twitter actually allows people to have kind of a stranger, more diverse experience where they can follow people who they actually don't know and who don't need to know them, but they can kind of build these interesting networks without having that approval process on the other end. And William Gibson, actually, just the other day in San Francisco, my friend Ken Goldberg was interviewing him, the great sci-fi cyberpunk author, and he had this great line where he said, Facebook feels like the mall, but Twitter feels like the street. And I think that's kind of key. I think that there are some networks that encourage us to kind of just hang out more with our friends, and then there are some networks that encourage us to actually go out and kind of discover new things and diversify our influences. And I think, you know, not all networks are created equal.
You talk about in Future Perfect, you tell a lot of stories, and in many ways, it seems that that's the key, that it doesn't necessarily have to be hierarchical in terms of the way we approach things, but there does, even within the context of peer networks, there does have to be some kind of narrative drive towards solving those problems.
You know, it's one of the things I've learned as a writer. You know, I came out of, I went to grad school here in New York, and, you know, was kind of in my early 20s writing a lot of kind of academic stuff that was more about theory. And if I were writing this book in that kind of mode, you know, 20 years ago, I would have written down a bunch of principles and explained the kind of philosophical tradition behind them and all that kind of stuff, which is interesting and relevant, but, and I try and do a little bit of that, but the truth is, if you're trying to kind of spread ideas and get people inspired, people like to hear narratives. You can't be too anecdotal. You know, it can be a crutch where all you have are anecdotes and there's no kind of evidence besides just a bunch of stories you strung together. And I spent a lot of time as a writer and kind of a thinker to try and get a good balance between kind of data and science and stories. But it is very important, I think, particularly when you're working in the form of a book or when you're speaking, which I do a lot of as well, to have those narratives to, in part because they're very spreadable, right? You know, when you tell a good story, people, it sticks with people, and then they go to the cocktail party that night and they say, oh my God, I just read the most interesting thing. And they tell the story and then it takes off.
What is the biggest obstacle that you see to this kind of peer progressive approach?
I think it's the feeling that it's just kind of naive and utopian, and that's why the internet and Wikipedia are so important, because you know that we can point to them now. It's not that they're the tools necessarily; it's that we can point to them and say, "I know it sounded like this kind of commune, you know, late '60s fantasy, but." The internet got built this way, and the web got built this way, and Wikipedia got built this way. So you cannot deny that this approach works in at least certain contexts. There may be many contexts where it doesn't work, and we can have that debate, and we can discover that as we explore the possibilities here. But to write it off wholesale as just this kind of naive fantasy, I think is no longer possible. But that's the biggest resistance, I think.
Stephen Johnson, his book is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Stephen, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Hey, it's always great, Jeff.
Thank you.